This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. As a chemist in the 1970s, Pat Nathan was quite often the only woman in the room. Things didn't change much as she rose through the ranks at the Dell Computer Company during the dot-com bubble. She entered the industry at a time when it was grappling with how to dispose computer waste responsibly. And despite an indication from her superior that she could never be a leader, her knowledge and perseverance made her an executive. And her understanding of what it takes for women to get those jobs with a fair salary made her an advocate. She combined that experience with her business management skills to start the Triangle Chapter of Dress for Success, a group that helps disadvantaged women find the right attire for interviews and provides job counseling. She retired for a second time earlier this year. Pat Nathan is my guest on the State of Things. Pat, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about growing up. You grew up in Lumberton in the 1950s and 60s, right?
I did. Lumberton is a small town, has remained one, and I just had a wonderful childhood. It's a very diverse community, which I loved about it. Small, and so you knew lots of people, very supportive. Both my parents worked, and I had that experience. Close friends. My birthday falls in October, and at that time, at least, you weren't allowed to go to school until you were 6 years old. So I had to start. I went to a private church kindergarten in first grade. So I was always a year younger than everyone in my class, and I was also what's called a late bloomer as a girl. And here I was, a tall, gangly kid, and not as developed as my other friends, and just kind of had a quiet childhood, I think, all in all.
Quiet, and one in which you developed an interest for the sciences.
I did. I always have loved animals, and my grandfather, who lived in Orange County in Chapel Hill, was a veterinarian, and I think that that and my love of animals, I loved biology and science and figures. My dad's an accountant, and I just always loved numbers and math.
Did anybody tell you as a girl in the 50s and 60s that science wasn't for women, wasn't for girls?
No, I have never thought of that, but they didn't. Perhaps it's because my family was so involved in that type of thing, and I had a wonderful chemistry teacher. You know, a teacher can make such a difference in a child's life, and she was a woman, and so she was a role model. I didn't realize that women weren't supposed to do that, Frank, so I did it.
It's a good thing you never heard that rubric. It was tough on a lot of women at the time. You were lucky, but you went to Meredith College. You studied chemistry, but that's not what you had intended to study.
No, I had not. At that point, when the freshmen went in to sign up for classes, it was done in alphabetical order. And being an N, I was later in the day. I had intended to sign up for freshman biology. That's what I needed to do. My plan was to go to Meredith for 2 years, then transfer to state to get my veterinary degree. And biology was already full, and so I was just so desperate, but I had to take chemistry instead. I think it was organic chemistry, and I did exceptionally well at it, and that was the beginning of my change to decide not to go to vet school, but to study chemistry instead.
Now, was that influential chemistry teacher somebody you met at Meredith, or had you met them in high school already?
Again, both. My high school teacher was the one who got me started, but then the woman who was Dr. Yarborough, who headed the department at that time at Meredith for a number of years, was also a great mentor and role model, and another professor, Sally Hunter. So they definitely influenced me as well.
Did you have a sense of what you were going to do with that degree?
I really did not. I really didn't understand what chemists did with that, the range of things that they could do. So when I first graduated, I went into laboratory chemistry. I was a bench chemist, basically, for the state of North Carolina in the Department of Food Science, which resides at North Carolina State University.
You did that for a while. I understand that you were, this is curious to me, you were the first class at Meredith to graduate with a BS instead of a BA in chemistry.
That's
is that
correct,
right?
Yes.
What is a BA in chemistry? I don't understand the distinction or why you could have a Bachelor's of Arts in chemistry. How did that work?
So the rest of your curriculum was more arts-based than science-based. So we had to, as a BS, you had to take a lot more science, German, that type of thing.
And so you did. And was that a first for Meredith? Then, in other
that's,
words, it shifted
right.
the program mm-hmm. a little bit.
That's correct.
So you did. And you talked about working in the lab for NC State. Mm-hmm. What kind of work were you doing?
I was there for 5 years doing research. You really don't want to know, I promise you, on the degradation of peanuts and other things, what happens to the chemistry of that. But doing that type of research and publishing, which is very important in that field.
But I should pay attention to the expiration dates is what I'm taking.
Yes, you should. There's a good reason for those, okay. But we won't go into that. So, yeah, I was there almost 5 years doing that type of work.
Wow. Now, did you like it?
You know, I really didn't like it. It was I'm pretty much right on the borderline of an introvert and an extrovert, but I do need some socialization. It was very much in a small lab with very little human interaction, and I didn't like the environment. It wasn't a pay-for-performance type environment per se, and I really didn't care for that because I felt like I was working really, really hard and felt that the compensation should be in line with that. So I started getting restless, and someone told me, hey, why don't you look at Data General, which is now EMC. They're down the road. And I thought, well, what in the world will a computer company want with a chemist? And I came to find out that they use a large number of chemical processes to print and etch the circuit boards that are in basically every electronic that you have. And I applied and got the job.
You have on your resume, watches peanuts decay. And that's not a big seller. But I want to leave that lab just too quickly because you were at Meredith, the Women's College. You studied, they've converted their Bachelor in Arts to a Bachelor in Science for Chemistry. So they're kind of moving that program into the sciences. What did you, was it a big change for you? Were you one of the few women in the lab at that time at NC State?
No, the bench chemists actually often are mm-hmm. are women working for male professors.
Was there much of a gender gap in terms of treatment and pay?
I don't remember there being so. I didn't have a lot of insight at that point into the pay. And frankly, I wasn't savvy enough to think about it, Frank, to be honest. Being one of my first jobs that I'd ever had, I really didn't think about comparing my pay to someone else's. And it wasn't something that you talked about a lot, but we did find out about increases and how increases were given out. And that's where I could tell my coworkers and myself there was some folks that worked in other positions, not chemist positions, that I was aware of, their pay.
I'm talking to the founder of the Triangle-based the Triangle franchise for Dress for Success, Pat Nathan, today on The State of Things. You moved on, as you said, and you moved into the tech industry. So tell us about that job.
Well, that job was fascinating. I loved it from the moment I walked into the place. I had studied statistics while I was at NC State, so I had that background. And this was the period of time where statistical process control was just getting to be heard of, important in the industry, and picking up on a lot of things that were going on in Japan on how to get waste out of your process, variability. And so that background, I loved being kind of leading edge in that, being one of the few people in that organization that understood that part of the business. And so I was able to go in and work in the department as an individual contributor, but fairly quickly began to lead a small quality organization there in the printed circuit board end of the business.
And so what were you doing?
We controlled all the line processes, the chemistry, the balances, did all the measurements and predictions and things like that, determined what to add. And we were also responsible for the outgoing quality of the product. So we had to really kind of negotiate any defects that there were, determine were they going to be electronically an issue or not, and determine whether to scrap the parts, et cetera.
Were you working with other suppliers at the time, or was it just in-house, this kind of quality control?
These were all basically in-house, a few suppliers, but pretty much all in-house. And it was a mixture of women and men, engineers, most men.
You know, you're getting to the point where you talked about also controlling waste, which we sort of got from the Japanese, that there's a lot of waste built in, and you can actually be a little smarter about this. It also, a lot of companies, particularly those dealing with chemicals, realized that they could solve some of their toxic waste problems by eliminating waste. They actually could save money. It wasn't sort of those who are opposed to environmental controls will tell us, oh, well, that's going to raise the cost of everything. Not always. Sometimes it brings the cost down because you've got a wasteful process.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. With a lot of variability, we were finding we were losing a lot of scrap. So that was the purpose, was to try to minimize that type of variability. So as I mentioned very quickly, I moved up to the head of that group. Then this particular plant had a mini computer manufacturing on one side of it and then the circuit boards on the other. And so I was asked to head up the quality then for the whole plant itself.
We'll see how that went and what it led to. And my conversation with Pat Nathan continues. Pat's the founder of the Triangle Chapter of Dress for Success. We're going to hear about her leadership role at Dell Computer Company in the dot-com era. You'll hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest this hour is Pat Nathan, founder of Dress for Success in the Triangle, and a former tech executive for the Dell Computer Company. Before the break, we were talking about women in management, and you were talking about the company at the time was called Data General, and you had become an executive and the head of, I think, supplier quality assurance, right?
That's right. About this time, I took over their supplier quality assurance. So this was a group of engineers that worked with our supply base to make sure that the incoming product, you know, met our controls, so our specifications. So this required us to go visit suppliers, have lots of meetings with them, discuss issues and get those rectified. And this was when I began to realize that I was a woman. I would walk into the room, and my name being Pat Nathan, I'd often get things like, well, where's Mr. Nathan? Well, I am Mr. Nathan. And the phone would ring, the same thing. I'd like to speak to Mr. Nathan. Mm-hmm. So I was often one of the few women, and certainly the few women managers or supplier quality managers that was around at that point.
Did you get a sense that once they realized you were Mr. Nathan, that you were being taken any less seriously?
You know, I don't think so much at that time, Frank. When you're in a technical field like that, and if you know your science, you start talking the science and everybody's on the same page, and I don't think so. When I led procurement a little bit later, that was a bit different because you're negotiating prices at that point and it gets to be a bit of a Olympic urination contest.
So I see. Well, so in this job, though, what kinds of products are you supervising then? Because you're having to go abroad. Some of the supplies are coming from other countries.
Primarily semiconductors. What we were negotiating, memory chips, and you'd have – you know, lots of difficulties getting parts. There was so much demand. This is in the middle of all the dot-com boom and computers and everything. So you're desperate to get parts. And yet, since you're a supplier quality, you've got to weigh the balance of the need for the parts with making sure the parts are right. So you have internal demands from folks that are materials folks trying to meet their schedules. Who can't you just bend a little bit on this time? Mm-hmm. Whereas you've also got your outgoing quality and your end customer that you need to make sure that you're taken care of.
Now, at this point, we're going to get you to Dell and the controversy over the chemicals and what's used in the process of making those and how they break down after they're disposed of. So there was a lot of and how workers are treated abroad. We're going to get there in a minute. But was this any part of your job in terms of quality control, supplier quality control, how they were treating employees or any of that?
Not at the time that I was with Data General, no. I don't remember those being issues or thought of whatsoever, topics of concern, just basically the quality of the parts and, you know, what's reliable, how good is good.
So we will get you to Dell. You moved to you jumped to Dell in Austin. Tell us about that move and why you decided to switch jobs.
Oh, it was a great move for me. I'd been at Data General almost 15 years at the time and wasn't looking for a job, but a headhunter called me and told me about this upstart company down in Texas that I had some awareness of. And I decided to go down and just do an interview and see. And it was one of those where they just flew you into the Admiral's Club at Dallas, did an interview, and that was it. You came right back, got right back on the plane and came home. And It was an interesting place. I was very attracted to the energy at that time and the potential growth and the kind of cowboy, cavalier attitude that the company had, and loved Austin as well. So I decided to make that move. And in that role, I was responsible for supplier quality for all of Dell, which was a much larger organization, and began my role that I would later hone of kind of brokering between different groups. The engineering group and the procurement group were always at odds, and I was part of procurement, and supplier quality was. So I was always trying to get these two groups, both headed by gentlemen, to talk to one another and to understand one another.
What were the misunderstandings about?
Again, procurement wanting to get the parts in fast, the right parts, you know, and the right price, engineering wanting different designs and that type of thing, and, of course, the quality, the constant focus on quality and why are you rejecting these? We've got to have these, that type of thing.
How would these – because I can imagine, you know, engineers who are making this product being very fussy about the specs on this thing. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a supplier on the other side saying, oh, come on, you know, the nanometer this way or that way ain't going to mean a thing. And you're saying, I want to make the sale. Who brokers that? I mean, who's the arbiter in that conversation?
Well, I guess the buck always stops with the big guy. But the supplier quality person has to represent the fact. Actual part of the statistical part of what's going to happen with these and what it's going to cost the company, and bring that up as a decision, except in the case where it's something that's a safety hazard. And then there's a kind of a process you go through. You can't ever risk a consumer's life over something.
How did you see your role in particular as you began to understand that part of your role was as broker in these departments that didn't seem to have even a common language? How did you feel yourself shaping that, and what did it become for you?
It was interesting, somewhat of a therapist role, I think, constantly trying to talk to people and understand theirs and then come back and say, but have you thought about this part of it? And just kind of constantly understanding people, listening, repackaging that, taking it to the other person and speaking in their vernacular so that they could relate to it, and living with the consequences and translating that back to my supply base.
Well, that's great. So an interpreter, but having that science base, having a solid foundation in the vocabulary of the sciences is going to make you a reliable broker. People are going to trust you.
That's essential, yes.
Yeah. So then you moved on. Talk about trying to make the case. There's a sustainability department that essentially gets created at about this time, right?
Right. Well, I was doing a three-year tour over in Europe and got a call that they were having some issues back in the States. And the issues were that there were protesters who were showing up in a variety of different places where, in particular, Michael would be speaking.
But Michael
also
Dell. Mm-hmm,
Michael Dell,
founder,
yes.
Right?
And also at annual shareholder meetings, there'd be protests outside, people wearing monitors on their heads and piles of e-waste, electronic waste, et cetera. And they basically called me and said, would you be willing to come back to the States and work in the public relations group for a little while to try to address this issue, to kind of make it go away?
Make it go away. Well, what did you make of that? What did you think they were asking you to do?
At that point, these are groups that Greenpeace, Silicon Valley Toxic Coalition, different groups that, to get attention, do it in pretty dramatic ways, and ways that might seem a bit absurd at times. So to make it go away was to basically explain the science of why these things weren't really issues, weren't toxic unless you were doing something ridiculous with them, and to speak over their concerns.
Why do you think they chose you for this?
Again, I had the background in the supplier quality. I had the technical background. I was relatively articulate and had to do some public speaking on some other things in the past, and I was available.
Well, the brass at the top really knew you could do it. You did have a boss along the way who did everything he could, apparently, to convince you otherwise, right?
I had one interesting boss that wasn't my boss for too long, that didn't think that I was tough enough. And he used some words that I found out I wasn't going to be able to use on the air today about how I needed to behave.
He said you weren't a big enough body part.
Yes.
Having to do with
lower body
digestive
part. Yes. Mm-hmm.
you know, the line, the comeback line, when he said you weren't big enough, you should have said, but I'm learning from the best. You didn't. You're too polite.
I didn't. You're too polite.
So you endured all of that. He's no longer there.
No.
You remained. And so essentially you develop a department called the Corporate Social Responsibility Department.
We did. As I came back and started looking at this, initially I did try to kind of speak over the voices that of concern, and I had to study what they were talking about. And the more I studied it and the more I listened to them, the more I could understand their perspective. And while the chances of these things happening were not great, there was a chance that they could happen. And as I thought about it and looked at our particular business model, it occurred to me that rather than fighting this, that there was a way that we could actually respond that would be in our interest as well as the public's interest by simply taking these computers back.
I want to talk more about that, but there's a junction point in here, because the first response of any corporation is to engage their public relations department and make it go away. They employed you in that project and, you know, developed their talking points and sent you out, right? I mean, tell us a little bit about the first kind of your first attempt to make it go away through the PR department.
First attempts had to do with simply going on air, short interviews with different reporters about this whole complex issue of toxicity of computers. And really, a reporter doesn't want to listen to too many cadmiums, leads, bromeliums before they just say, okay, that's enough. But talking in an intelligent way that kind of made the problem, minimized the problem.
And you were doing that, and that's when you had this epiphany that just the talking points weren't enough. Because people who were protesting did have a point. And we're talking about the parts that go, the lead, the cadmium, there's essentially asbestos that goes into some of the fire retardants mm-hmm. that gets plasticized. All of these things, not too dangerous while you're using the computer, but after, in its afterlife, the disposal of that computer becomes a really serious matter. And this was the nut of the protest, right?
That was the nut of the protest, is what are you doing with it at end of life? And that it was the manufacturer's responsibility to both educate the public about the dangers and then also to provide an easy, efficient way of responsibly recycling the computers.
So when you go back to senior management, you say, you know, they might just have something here, but I think there's a way of managing mm-hmm. both their concerns and also, you know, protecting our bottom line. What was their response, their initial response?
I actually ended up going directly to Michael Dell because I thought that he would understand this whole approach. And my approach to him was, look, we are the only company that sells direct to the end user. We know where 99% of our computers are right this minute because we sold it to that customer. We are the only ones who can responsibly then say to that customer, hey, here's how you recycle it. Here's what we want you to do at the end of life. And he agreed. He saw that could be a business opportunity for us and solve an environmental problem or potential environmental problem at the same time.
So tell us how it worked then. What were your initial, the ways you're going to get these computers back?
Well, after he agreed to it, then I had to figure out how to do it, which was kind of interesting. But, you know, Frank, I started thinking about how do you recycle things now? What do you do with your clothing when you don't no longer need that or your household goods? And many of us take it to a local charity. And so I looked at which ones are large nationally and did some research on how many different facilities they had and who would have a good infrastructure, and approached Goodwill at their national headquarters and said, hey, would you like to partner on this particular opportunity? What is an issue right now, but I think could be a real plus for us both.
And of course, you're not going to just dump the problem on them. The idea is that everybody would be properly trained at dismantling and proper handling of these.
Not only properly trained, but that they would have a way of earning income from the recycling so that it would be a benefit to them to be doing it, and they would be giving skills to the people that they are trying to help, that they're getting technical skills in the whole technical recycling process itself.
So that worked pretty well. And then there were concerns about the way workers abroad are treated, those who are working for Apple and Dell and other computer companies, to help manufacture these. And that became a kind of another level of concern.
Yes, there was, and continue to be to this day, of course, concerns about the amount of the content of these products that are outsourced, that are procured primarily from Asia, and the workers, and the rights of those workers that are in those factories. And that's a tough thing, a very, very hard thing when you're sitting in a headquarters in Austin, Texas, to try to figure out how in the world are you going to be able to influence that. And there's a fairly small group of sustainability people at this point. And so I knew the head of each one for our competitors, HP, Compaq, they weren't together at the time, IBM. And we all got together and decided, talked about the problem, and decided to come up with a supplier code of conduct for the electronics industry. So that rather than bringing the requirements up for just Dell, and hence the prices, that we would do it for all of these leading companies, and that by doing that, the labor pool would be better treated, our products would be better sourced. They may be a little bit more expensive, but it would be across all of us, so it wouldn't be a competitive disadvantage to any of us by doing this. So we'd be doing the right thing for the right reason and none of us suffering our business.
That makes perfect sense to me. I wonder if it did initially to all of those. I mean, that's bringing a lot of people together who are taking a little bit of a risk because they know all of our prices are going to go up and they're hoping it all happens at the same time. Was it a tough sell?
It wasn't a tough sell. Surprisingly, it wasn't. Perhaps it was the time, a bit of preaching to the choir. And at that time, I think their management was all in the right mindset of this type of thing as well. So my memory of it is that it went fairly smoothly for all of us.
Talking to Pat Nathan today about her experience at Dell Computers. We're doing that on the State of Things. Also about women in business, which is a big part of this conversation. But I'm thinking about that computer buyback, because here you are again, the broker, the one who can speak across the lines, around the table, and get everybody together to find a common language around common goals. You did that at a computer buyback. I think it was the first one in Denver, right, where they were bringing computers back. And tell us about that experience.
That was one of our early efforts. We would go into large cities and have a Saturday where people could bring in their electronic equipment. And this was fairly early in this whole process. And so there was a huge, huge demand for it. And in Denver, we did it at Mile High Stadium, had the whole parking lot, and there was going to be a game the next day, but we had the whole parking lot for the day before. And we had it set up so that you could just drive through, and we had volunteers there who would unload your car. Well, within a few hours of opening, we had actually blocked the interstate. We got a police came by and said, the interstate is shut down on this particular lane because of the backup. You've got to unload these things more quickly. The Denver Fire Department showed up unbeknownst to us, and firemen started helping us. They'd finished their shift. They start helping unload the car. And there were protesters there who were protesting the fact that we were using at that point part of the U.S. prison system is to recycle electronics. There's something called Unicor. We were using that particular service. They were protesting that. They had on these the garb, the outfits of prison uniforms. And I walked over to the protesters and just said, look, you know, if you guys want to be part of this solution, could you just come help us unload the cars so we can take care of this? And they did. So it looked a little bit ridiculous, but we had people in prison costumes unloading cars, firemen, and volunteers.
Pat, you went to the protesters who were opposed to your disposal plan, and you got them to help take the computers out of the cars.
We did.
It's pretty incredible. And I suppose we should talk just for a moment about that, because initially, I mean, it sort of makes sense to maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I don't think it does make sense to ask inmates to do that kind of work, but you really ran into some problems pretty early on because, again, of the training involved, right? I mean,
they were concerned again by the same groups that this was abusing the prisoners' right, that there wasn't healthy conditions under which they were working. I visited one prison myself in Florida to try to assess this. It was easy access, but a bit difficult to really assess what you were seeing. Was that what you would see every day? Because you can't, whereas with my supply base, I could make an unannounced visit. That doesn't go over real well in prison. So I had enough concern about were the proper controls and were we going to be able to visit often enough to be able to maintain that, that I felt that it was best if we discontinue that process as well.
Talking today to Pat Nathan. She is the founder of the Triangle Chapter of Dress for Success. We'll talk about that when our conversation continues on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Pat Nathan. She's the founder of the organization Dress for Success in the Triangle. And we were talking about your time at Dell Computer. You ended up, you retired ultimately from Dell.
I did in 2005. While I lived in Europe, I met a wonderful, wonderful Irishman. And we both decided to quit our jobs in 2005. We got married and he moved over to the U.S. and we locked the house in Austin, bought an RV and a truck, which we had neither one been in, either of one in the past, and took off for 6 months.
See, that's everybody's dream, right? I'm going to retire. I'm going to get an RV. We're just going to travel the country. Well, how did it go?
That part was absolutely wonderful. We really, really enjoyed that. It was a wonderful way to get to know someone and to kind of explore what you wanted to do with the second half of your life.
And you decided to do what?
Well, after about a year of that, I knew I had a lot of energy. I had time. I had some resources. And I decided that I wanted to get involved helping women. And I need to go back to my time in London because I had started a chapter there of something called WITI, Women in Technology International, which is just what it sounds like, a group of women that are in high tech, kind of working together to overcome some of the challenges that we faced. Started one in England, and for our community outreach project, someone said, well, let's do a suit drive for Dress for Success, London. We did, and they brought a poster in that shows a woman from the tip of her nose to the bottom of her business jacket. And in big, bold type across the poster, it says, to some women, this is a life jacket. And that visual of that woman standing there with her business suit, her life jacket on, just really, really had emblazoned in my subconscious. And that came back, that floated back, and I looked into what it would take to start one here because there wasn't one. And I embarked on that process in 2007, and then April Fool's Day, 2008, was given the license, basically, for a chapter here in the Triangle.
Tell us how the program works.
Program's fantastic. We work with over 100 different local nonprofits, government agencies, schools, to serve women who are unemployed or underemployed and seeking employment. They all are low income, living in below the poverty level, and they come in and initially get a suiting and initial career counseling to see where they are, what they need to work on, and then they can enroll in any number of different programs and processes we have to help them hone their skills, their interview skills, from preparing resumes to business cards to practicing to getting them to go back to school to get a GED, etc.
So where do the clothes come from and how are you financed?
The clothes come from the community primarily. We do have retailers who also give us end of season, but most of it is from the community. And the financing also comes from the community. More than 50% of it is from individuals. We also raise about a fourth of our income by selling excess inventory several times a year. And then there are grants from foundations and small government grants as well, very small.
So early on, you were kind of doing everything, huh?
Oh, yes. When you start a nonprofit, it's an interesting process. But, yes, you do everything. And it's still a small organization. We were all volunteer and still 99% of the services are provided by people in the community.
But that's an interesting part of the process because you're having to meet with anybody who can help you. So that's people in the community, business people on up to the governor. You're also having to keep the place clean.
Yep. You have to keep the place clean. You have to pick up clothes, schlep clothes. You serve women. You answer the telephone. You do interviews. You do everything.
And you can be exhausted, and I understand that there was a day that you were, and you got one phone call at the end of a very long life, it must have felt like, but a very long day, and you took it. Tell us about that.
These were the very early days. This was in August of 2008 when we had just opened the doors a few months earlier. It was the end of a day on a Thursday. I was walking out the door, just turning the light off, the phone rings, and it's someone from Durham Social Services, the housing department, actually, saying that she had a resident who had a job interview the next morning, and could I possibly help this woman, that she was just a great woman. She'd had a lot of hard breaks, and would I be willing to stay late and help her? It was hot. I didn't want to, but I said, okay, what size is she, et cetera. How fast can you get her here? So 20 minutes later, Jacqueline walks in the door, and she was nervous. You could tell she felt she was putting me out by having me stay, and I tried to reassure her and got her in the suit that I'd pulled for her. And in our dressing rooms, we don't have mirrors because we don't want the women making judgments on themselves. They may never have seen themselves in a business suit before, or their idea of what a good fit and what we feel is appropriate for an interview may be very different. So she comes out in her suit. She hasn't seen herself yet. I turn her around. I put a little strand of pearls around her, and then together we approach the mirror. I'm standing by her side. She looks in the mirror, and she just freezes. And from her profile, I could see her bottom lip just starts to tremble, and then projectile tears come out. So my first reaction, I grab a Kleenex and say, don't get it on your suit. You're going to get it messed up, and you need to interview in this suit tomorrow. It looks so good. So I said, Jacqueline, what's the matter? What's wrong? Why are you crying? And she turns and she looks at me and she says, Miss Pat, I look like a lady.
Wow.
So 5 years, 6 years later, that still makes me moves me to think that she had never seen herself that way, and that something as simple as putting her in a beautiful, clean outfit and putting pearls around her and then turning her to the mirror, she could see herself in a whole different light. Her posture changed. She threw her shoulders back. She stood up straight, and she went in the next day, and she nailed it.
It indicates how much is involved in this, that certainly you need the right clothes for that interview if you're going to make any impression, but the impression it makes on that individual. It's the first time they've ever taken themselves seriously or been taken seriously by somebody who would stay an extra minute to put a string of pearls around their neck.
You've got it. So many times we've heard women say things like, I never knew I could look like this. No one ever told me this. I've never had anyone to show me how to do this, or I've never seen anyone do this, et cetera. So lack of role models, lack of affirmation, someone who agrees that looks wonderful, that's what you should be doing.
It's interesting because you quite understandably were wanting to help women in your profession. You had seen the obstacles and the roadblocks that women who had an education and all the right stuff for a career, all the obstacles that they faced, and you were trying to help them. Had it ever occurred to you, had you ever thought about helping women who didn't have an education or hadn't had jobs before?
I didn't. I was encouraged, actually, when I did retire, to start coaching executive women, people who were trying to make it to the top. And somehow that just didn't resonate. I think I had returned to the Triangle, had heard so much about how successful the Triangle was. It was number one in this, number one in that, et cetera. And then I drove around. My mom's from Durham. My dad's from Chapel Hill. And I could see so much poverty. And it just didn't jive with what I was hearing. And the more I learned about the poverty, in particular with single women in the area, I knew that that's what I needed to be working on. As you said, I had so many advantages, and it was hard for me. What in the world can it be like when you don't have those advantages, you don't have role models, and you don't have access to simple assets like dental care, clothing, basic hygiene needs?
Yeah, and you might be taking care of a couple of kids, and transportation can be an issue, and so all of those things complicate the story. How many women do you see, and where do they come? Are they all referrals, or do they find you by the
basically,
means?
They're all referrals, yes. And this year, the organization here locally will serve 1,750 women, and they've served little over 7,000 since the day we first opened the door 6 years ago.
Wow. And you have community volunteers as well who kind of work at the store and help people out, right?
We have almost 300 community volunteers that serve anything from being we call it an image coach, someone who works with her on how how she looks physically, to career coaches who are working on her career training, et cetera, to volunteers who help with our excess inventory sales, people who help with marketing. There's every need in the world that a normal business would have, we have, and the community responds to it in spades.
How about follow-up? I mean, once they get the job, if they get it, do you stay with them?
Yes, it's a continuum of programs. There's a kind of a job boot camp. We find that the first 6 months for a job is the most tenuous time. If you haven't made childcare provisions in the past, you know, you have a four-year-old, the average cost is a little over $6,000 a year for childcare. You've got a lot of bills already that you're backlogged and you're starting this new job. What are you going to do with the child? Helping women from that first 6 months period to get over those types of barriers, transportation, knowing which bus to take. And then after that, there's a program we call the Professional Women's Group, where the women can come back, network with one another, and deal with things, opportunities. How do you take a feedback on an appraisal and use it positively? How do you ask for a promotion? How do you ask for more pay? All those types of challenges that we all have, men and women.
You did a little assertiveness training after your experience with that manager we talked about, Adele.
I did, to learn to be a little bit more tough and how to feel a bit more comfortable. And I say a bit more. I think I still struggle with that. But to be more assertive. And I have found that, in particular, working with the women of Dress for Success, that it's a lot easier to be that way. The reason that we're successful is we're all there for that woman. That's the reason that we come in every day and that we pick up every piece of clothing. And it's much easier for me to be assertive when I am assertive for her.
You started that at a rough time. We talked about 2007, 2008, and that's when Wall Street crashed our economy. It made it pretty tough on you.
Yes, it wasn't great planning, Frank, in one way, but it was in another. I've often said that had I realized how hard it was going to be, how much work it was going to take those first 5 years, I don't think I would have done it. And I'm just so very thankful that I didn't know that, because it's by far the most worthwhile thing that I have done.
You did it. You got it up and running. It's a success now. So you felt comfortable, I guess, to retire yet again.
Yes, that's true. We found a fantastic leader in Beth Briggs, who was heading up the North Carolina Commission for Women, and made the decision to come lead this wonderful organization. And she's now at the helm and doing a fantastic job.
And now you are focusing on ways to get equal treatment and equal pay for women. Tell us about your efforts these days.
Well, I'm working more on our international level with Dress for Success, really looking at the how to bring in more affiliates and get this business, this organization, out to more women. Most of the people who start nonprofits don't have a business background, and I think that it's really critical that they very early in their startups get access to that through some through volunteers, through some source like Executive Service Corps or SCORE, or there are lots of different organizations that can do that, and that also that there be some basic business operations processes in place that we can hand those organizations as they start, so they're not reinventing the wheel each time that they try to start an organization.
Yeah, it really is a business, and I think that's what you find very often, is that people who want to start a nonprofit do it for the sort of the base reason. They want to help that, serve that problem, the community. But you need some skills to run the business.
Absolutely. It's just as critical in a nonprofit. I often say more critical, because you're talking about somebody's life in these cases. And very, very important that you have that. I had a volunteer say to me one time, "Pat, you just run this thing just like a business." And I'm like, "Well, hello, it is a business."
Yes, ma'am, that's what we're doing. Talking to Pat Nathan, founder of the Triangle Chapter of Dress for Success, today on The State of Things. How are things for women these days? How do they compare, do you think, for women executives in particular? Have things gotten better, worse? Are they about the same as when you started?
Well, I've heard that in the IT industry that the statistics on women in leadership has remained pretty much the same. It's around 17%. I haven't gone back and looked at that by company, but I don't think it's changed a whole lot there. Certainly, there was a great report that came out in 2012, I think, but it was based on data from 2010, but on the status of women in North Carolina, that shows over the last 30 years that it has improved quite a bit. But there's still a long ways to go, Frank. I think there's like a 17.5% pay gap still. Unemployment certainly is higher for women, and it's like three times higher for single women raising families.
Which means you have to be conscious of that, and I understand that you are when you're even sending out resumes, that having a woman's name at the top of the resume, you've learned, can be a liability.
It can, and I have to say, I think that my name was Pat Nathan was an asset for me, that I didn't get excluded. In early in my efforts around Dress for Success, as I was leaving Dell, I read a book by Dr. Nancy Etcoff. It's called Survival of the Prettiest, The Science of Beauty. And it's an odd title, but she explains, goes back and does a lot of research on why we value symmetry, why we pick like women with lush hair. It's not because we like thick hair. It's because it shows you don't have parasites and you're good for breeding. And there's behavior that we still have today that is based on our evolution and our need to evolve and continue. And I just found it fascinating. And whereas I don't think a lot of people are aware that they're doing things, we're subconsciously constantly sorting. And in a time when there was so much unemployment, so few jobs, and you were competing with so many people, it was important to remove anything, any types of barriers, conscious or unconscious, that you could in that application process. So difficult names, difficult to understand, things that would seem foreign, anything you can do to get rid of that and make it more generic, and then also things in your resumes that date you. If you're over 55 and, you know, you're starting at grade school, you know, you can rework your resume so that it looks younger, you're using younger language, and you don't have a timeline.
All of it honest, obviously. You're not changing the facts.
Absolutely.
Pat, it's a great story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Pat Nathan is the founder of the Triangle Chapter of Dress for Success. This Thursday, she's going to be on a panel. It's December 4th. It's about women in business and nonprofits. It's 8 in the morning at the Levin JCC Center in Durham. And we'll have information about that panel on women in the business world that Pat Nathan will attend at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Intern Alex Curley, Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.